Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Hello, this is Miriam Raftery wishing all of you a great weekend. Looks like it's going to be sunny, warm weather through the weekend. However, the National Weather Service has issued a red flag alert for high fire danger due to hot, dry conditions. So please be vigilant out there, folks. Now, I've also got an update on the fires that began late Thursday. There were three of them. It burned over 40 acres. From El Cajon to Alpine along Interstate 8, homes were threatened, and there were advisory evacuations, but fortunately, thanks to the hard work of our firefighters out there, no homes were lost. Now, CAL FIRE is investigating the possibility that arson was responsible for these fires, so folks, be vigilant. If you're driving out there on the freeway and you see something suspicious, please report it to the authorities, and have a great weekend.
This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, and I'm here with Miriam Raftery, who's the editor of East County Magazine. And this time of year, there's so much going on in Sacramento because it's the end of the legislative session, and over 400 bills came to the governor's desk.
I don't think I could even read 400 bills in the flurry of time they have, so it's real important for everyone to know what's going on up there.
And it's not just what they passed, but it's what they didn't pass that's important. One thing that really stands out is the governor did not sign the moratorium on fracking in California. What is that all about, Miriam?
Well, there was a bill, SB 4, that called for a moratorium on fracking and also some tightening of regulations and better reporting. Basically, what happened was the oil industry convinced legislators to gut the bill and take out the moratorium. However, it does have some regulation of fracking, and in case you don't know what that is the hydraulic fracturing method of injecting sand, water, and chemicals to free up the oil and gas that is trapped in shale deep underground. And there are concerns that it can contaminate water, groundwater sources. So what the bill does do is it requires permitting of wells, notifying the neighbors living near the drilling where this is going on, and testing of groundwater, as well as a study of the fracking's impact on the environment. And it goes into effect in January.
We've all seen the effect of fracking on some of the drinking water. In fact, they've even been able to light the water on fire, so it's affected groundwater. So do you think these protections will be enough?
I personally don't. I've heard enough about the fracking that I wouldn't want to live next door to where it's going on, but at least it's a start. The Sierra Club calls it disappointing. However, there is another bill that not everybody's heard about, and that is SB 665. And this one requires bonding requirements to make sure that oil drillers or gas drillers will be able to pay for the cost of repairing any environmental damage that they might cause. The bill's author, Lois Wolk, Senator Wolk, says this will shift the financial burden of responding to abandoned wells or other violations from taxpayers to oil and gas drillers. So I guess I would say it's a step in the right direction. A lot of people would say it doesn't go far enough, but it is at least taking some steps to make the oil industry more responsible, for the environmental harm.
Well, that does sound good, to hold them responsible and accountable. One bill that Jerry Brown did sign into law was AB 1371, which requires drivers of motor vehicles to allow at least 3 feet when passing a bicycle on a highway traveling in the same direction under most circumstances. Mm-hmm. How is this a good bill?
Well, it's certainly a good bill if you're a bicyclist. It gives you a lot more protection. Bikers have long complained that truckers will go roaring past them or other motorists, and there's certainly been accidents and some sad situations there.
It does seem like sometimes the motorists try to get just as close as they can to the bicyclists. But you notice this law only applies to highways. Not city surface streets.
That's correct. And also, there's been some misunderstanding. Some motorists on the blogs are complaining that, but what if I can't pass them safely? Well, actually, the law does address that. The 3-foot rule only applies if you can do so safely. If you cannot do so safely, let's say the highway is too narrow, it's foggy, there's a pothole, you can't see around the curve, then what you need to do is simply slow down and pass carefully at a safe speed, the slowest that you can safely do. certainly, hopefully, will cut down on highway fatalities for bicyclists.
Now, Jerry Brown also signed the Domestic Workers Bill.
It gives certain domestic workers, such as in-home nannies and healthcare workers, overtime pay for working more than 9 hours a day or more than 45 hours a week. There's a couple of exceptions in there. Mealtimes don't count, snack breaks, and if you're just an occasional babysitter, you won't get this. This is only for those people that are really doing this on a regular basis. Now, what's interesting is that just last week, there was a federal court ruling that said that you have to provide minimum wage and overtime to home health care workers. What's significant about the state action that Brown signed is that it includes in-home child care workers, and these people were not included in the federal bill. So it definitely goes a step further toward helping nannies and the folks taking care of people's children.
So what else has the governor signed?
Well, there's an interesting one. Now, kids, how many of you out there have some point in time maybe posted a picture you come to regret later on the internet or tweeted something that you wish you could take back when it comes time to go looking for a job and your employer is out there Googling you? Well, guess what? You're in luck. Governor Brown signed a bill known as the Eraser Bill for teenagers. The measure is SB 568, and it's improving the privacy protections for minors on the internet. Basically, it allows children and adolescents under the age of 18 to remove posts on the internet and social media sites. It doesn't protect you if somebody else already reposted it somewhere. It's not going to make the servers take that down. But you do have the right as a minor to go in and remove material that you posted yourself. The other thing the bill does is it prohibits the advertising of products that are deemed harmful to minors and that are targeted specifically to minors. That includes alcohol, tobacco, and actually also guns. The intent is to protect minors, just as you're not allowed to have TV ads that target minors for cigarettes and for alcohol. This closes that loophole online. Another bill impacting minors. This one was signed into law by the governor, SB 260, and what this one does is if somebody was convicted of certain crimes and they were minors at the time, they now can petition to have their case reviewed for possible release in as little as 15 years into a prison sentence. This is designed to not lock up minors and throw away the keys for something that they did when they were teenagers. It doesn't apply to everybody. I believe there's an exemption for those that were given life with no possibility of parole. If you're a mass murderer or something, this is not your get-out-of-jail-free card. But certainly for people who were in there for more minor offenses, this is giving them a second chance.
So what else is new on the governor's desk?
Well, there's a whole lot of them, but just to go over a couple more, one that may be of interest to some folks is SB 717. And what that does is it makes it easier to get blood samples from drunk drivers who don't want to give their blood sample. What it does is it allows law enforcement officers to get a warrant in those cases. There's been a court decision that said you can't take blood without a warrant, and this basically says that if you're suspected of being a drunk driver, they can get one. Another one is AB 1391. What this does is it lets police who suspect that property in a pawn shop might be stolen or a secondhand shop to put a 90-day hold on the sale of the property and to seize the property as evidence if needed in a criminal trial. Now there's one more, and that is SB 639. And what that one does is it goes to the Federal Affordable Health Care Act, or Obamacare, and it sets some caps on how much your out-of-pocket expenses could be if you're buying health coverage through the new state insurance exchange. And again, that one is SB 639. These have been some of the highlights or lowlights, depending on your point of view, of what the legislature's been doing this session. And we've saved maybe the most important bill for last, and that is a measure that is going to increase the minimum wage. So if you're a minimum wage worker out there, listen up. This bill affects you. Assembly Bill 10, the new law, will raise California's minimum wage to $9 an hour starting July 1st, 2014, and up to $10 an hour by January 1st, 2016. And now Leon is going to give us some historical perspective on this important issue.
California Governor Jerry Brown signed into law a bill raising the minimum wage. In doing so, he said, "The minimum wage has not kept pace with the rising costs. This legislation is overdue and will help families that are struggling in this harsh economy."
Out of the 38 bills designated as job killers by the powerful California Chamber of Commerce and their Political Action Committee, the minimum wage bill is the only one signed by the governor. The chamber has poured millions of dollars into campaigns to help elect Republicans and business-friendly Democrats to the Democrat-dominated California legislature. Assemblymember Brian Jones from Santee said, "It is clear California is not a business-friendly state. It will drive up payroll costs so that businesses hire fewer people or, worse, cut the hours of hard-working Californians." But Assembly Speaker John Perez argues that raising wages is good for business and will boost the bottom line overall. He said, "The real winner here is the economy. This is money that will be spent at grocery stores, on school supplies, and invested in education, and ultimately strengthens the recovery." Perez noted that California's job market is the fastest growing in the nation. Historically speaking, Winston Churchill said in 1919 that lacking a minimum wage law would be a condition of progressive degeneration. He believed that someone was always willing to work for less and thus creating a race to the bottom. Business groups and their political allies have been railing against the minimum wage ever since President Franklin D. Roosevelt proposed it during the Depression to help stimulate the economy. The critics warned that enacting a minimum wage would destroy employees' drive to work hard and would force many firms out of business. The minimum wage law, warned the National Association of Manufacturers in 1937, constitutes a step in the direction of communism, Bolshevism, fascism, and Nazism. Roosevelt and most members of Congress ignored these warnings and adopted the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938, establishing the federal minimum wage of 25 cents an hour. Since then, each time Congress has considered raising the minimum wage, business groups and conservatives have repackaged the same arguments. In 1945, the National Association of Manufacturers claimed that the proposed jump from an hourly minimum of 40 cents to 65 cents at once and 70 to 75 cents in the following years is a reckless jolt to the economic system. Living standards, instead of being improved, would fall, probably to record lows. Instead, the next three decades saw the biggest increase in living standards in the nation's history.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. The City of Lemon Grove and Lemon Grove Historical Society are celebrating, and they invite the public to a grand opening party on the Main Street Promenade, Friday evening, September 27th from 4 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. This hometown event celebrates the completion of the Pioneer Modernism Park at the Main Street Promenade and welcomes Lemon Grove's newest neighbors from Citronica One, the brand new colorful and modernistic residential and business structure recently completed near Highway 94 and the Lemon Grove Trolley Station. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow is the name chosen for the Pioneer Modernism Park, evoking Lemon Grove's history. Visitors can view the new wonderful installations at the park, such as the wind spire, tractor slide, mosaics, charming seats, and windmill. Visitors are encouraged to bring the children, friends, and colleagues to enjoy dancers, singers, jugglers, and magicians, to play in contests of hula hoop, jump rope, bubble blowing, and whistling, and to enjoy free cookies and lemonade and much more. It's time for Oktoberfest season in East County. Sponsored by the German-American Societies of El Cajon, the El Cajon Oktoberfest spans two weekends, beginning on Friday, September 27th, through Sunday, September 29th, and then the following weekend from October 4th through 6th. Included in the festivities for this family-friendly event are a band from Germany in traditional dress called Guggenbachbaum, authentic German food such as bratwurst, ox on the spit, potato salad, potato pancakes, sauerkraut, red cabbage, and a variety of German pastries and pretzels. Plus, there are games and activities for the whole family, with a kids' zone and vendors and crafts booth. El Cajon's Oktoberfest is located at the German-American Societies of San Diego, Incorporated, on Mollison Avenue in El Cajon. Is La Mesa ready for steampunk? On Friday, September 27th, costumed steampunk fans are expected to join the celebration of A Day in the Life, an original oil painting art show opening at O'Dunn Fine Art Gallery on La Mesa Boulevard. Steampunk is a science fiction genre that blends elements of technology with 19th century settings, often with alternative endings. Gallery owner Shannon O'Dunn says it promises to be a lot of fun, even if you are not into steampunk. The exhibit will feature a replica of the Time Machine, seen in the 1960 movie Time Machine and in The Big Bang Theory. One artist from Colorado, Steve Bonomo, has taken the characters from the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album and reinterpreted them as steampunk characters. Artists will be on hand, and the event also offers live music, food, and beverages. The Alpine Stagecoach Lions present the Alpine Viejas Western Days Parade and Craft Fair on Sunday, September 29th. The parade will begin at Albertsons at 2 p.m., and continue down Alpine Boulevard to Alpine Creek Town Center, where the craft fair and car show will be held. Visit alpinedaysparade.com for more information. Acumba hikers and walkers are on the move again this Saturday, September 28th, to the Stair Climber. This 3-mile walk is rated moderate and is a great cardiovascular workout on a series of 3 hills along the border fence. It is also dog-friendly, with dogs on a 6-foot leash. Meet at 8 a.m. at the Acumba Lounge on Old Highway 80 in Acumba Hot Springs. The La Mesa Historical Society will continue its free History Roundtable series for 2013 with a presentation on the architectural heritage of La Mesa, titled Emor Brooke Weaver, Pioneer Architect. The presentation features Alexander D. Beville, a historian with California State Parks, and it will be held on Saturday, September 28th at 10 a.m. at Grossmont Healthcare District Auditorium on Wakarusa Drive in La Mesa. Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection District invites the public to an open house at the Julian Fire Station on Saturday, September 28th from 10 to 4. The station is located on Farmers Road, which becomes Main Street, just east of Julian's historic town district. Guests can enjoy games, firefighter competitions, food, music, demonstrations, as well as tours of the station, trucks, ambulance, and helicopter. Also in Julian are some recurring events. The first two are both at Jeremy's on the Hill restaurant in the Wainola area, just outside downtown Julian on Highway 78. Every Monday and Thursday, listen to live music at an open mic on the patio at Jeremy's on the Hill starting at 6 p.m. And every Friday and Saturday, enjoy live piano music with Steve Clark at Jeremy's on the Hill. Then at the Pine Hills Lodge in Julian, every Friday there is live entertainment in the pub from 8 p.m. to 12 midnight. Pine Hills Lodge is located on La Posada Way in Julian. Best Night of Free Comedy is this Thursday, September 26th, and starts at 8:30 p.m. This is a recurring event on the last Thursday night of every month at the Regal on La Mesa Boulevard in La Mesa. Their headliners have been on Comedy Central, The Improv, Gabriel Iglesias' Stand Up Revolution, and have toured with other well-known comedians. A wine tasting to benefit the rebuilding efforts of the Sierra Club Cabin will be held on Sunday, September 29th at 4 p.m. at the Mosaic Wine Bar on 30th Street in the North Park area of San Diego. The Sierra Club invites the public to this benefit event for rebuilding the cabin, which was lost in the Chariot Fire in July of this year on Mount Laguna. Now a preview for an upcoming event. Saturday evening, October 5th, is the second annual Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation's Art in the Park. Featured art from a minimum of 45 award-winning artists will be on display and for sale, with over 100 pieces of nature-related art featuring a variety of painting styles, ceramics, photography, and sculptures. CBS 8 meteorologist and lifestyle reporter Sean Stiles and Mission Publishing Group publisher Jim Matifer return as honorary co-chairs for this event in the Visitor's Center from 6 to 9 p.m. Enjoy an evening of fine art, fine wine, fine cheese, and fine chocolate. Entertainment will be provided by members of the San Diego Native American Flute Circle, followed by the Caprice Strings Trio. The San Diego Astronomy Association will have telescopes on the terrace for viewing the stars. Tickets are required and can be ordered at www.mtrp.org. And this just in, another event upcoming for next weekend, October 4th, 5th, and 6th, is the Oktoberfest in La Mesa on La Mesa Boulevard. All of this information and more is in our festival and events section and on our comprehensive calendar online at www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County!
This is Miriam Raftery again with a very important health warning, folks. Listen up. Arizona officials are reporting the first two cases in the United States of addicts using a very dangerous drug called Crocodile. That's spelled K-R-O-K-O-D-I-L. Now, this drug rots the skin from the inside out after first turning your skin green and scaly, hence the name. It can cause gangrene and amputation of limbs. Time magazine did an investigation of this drug in Russia where it started, and they found that the average user dies within just 2 or 3 years after the first time they inject this mixture. Now, Crocodile, or desamorphone, is an opiate. It is cheaper and far more potent than heroin, and unfortunately, fairly easy to make. It's been called the world's most horrifying drug, also known as the zombie apocalypse drug. Illegal drug dealers and users make it by combining codeine with iodine, gasoline, paint thinner, hydrochloric acid, lighter fluid, and red phosphorus, which the addicts then inject. The drug ruptures blood vessels and it causes the flesh to rot away and even exposing the bone. Crocodile was first reported in 2002 in Russia, where there are over a million or more crocodile addicts now. The drug has since spread to other European countries, and U.S. officials have long worried that it would turn up here. Now it has, right here in Arizona, just over our border, folks from California. At the Good Samaritan Poison and Drug Information Center in Banner, Arizona, Dr. Frank Lovecci summed it up this way to CBS News. We're extremely frightened. So, folks, if you know anybody that's involved in the drug culture, please warn them about this. It's the most dangerous drug we've ever seen here in the United States, according to the health authorities. So if someone offers you Crocodile, my advice is tell them, see you later, alligator.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
The County Board of Supervisors voted unanimously on Wednesday to approve a work plan for a comprehensive renewable energy plan. It includes options to create an alternative to San Diego Gas and Electric Company, such as a utility district that could be owned by the people. It also includes plans for the type and scale and location of energy development. The work plan will analyze ways that the county can move forward with renewable energy options. The board heard public comments and deliberated for nearly 2 hours before reaching its decision. The plan drew support from the energy industry, but serious concerns were raised by many rural residents. Supervisor Diane Jacob called the plan a roadmap and said we need the research before we formulate or change any potential policies, and this work plan will do that. But Donna Tisdale, chair of the Boulevard Planning Group in East County, called on supervisors to protect the backcountry. Renewable energy planning is good if done right, she said, but we would like certainty too. We would like where we live to be protected. The backcountry has value, but it is under attack, under assault. After the vote, Tisdale told East County Magazine, we supported the renewable energy plan, but we wanted it done right. The stakeholders advisory group is biased and stacked. Now, in fact, that advisory group includes only industry representatives from the energy corporations and groups representing them. It has no representatives on behalf of residents, environmentalists, or Native American tribes who have voiced concerns over sacred sites. Supervisor Jacob told those opposed that she understands their concerns, but that this is only a plan to gather more information. A staffer of hers afterward noted that as the plan evolves, community planning groups will be consulted, but that still leaves many residents, environmentalists, and tribes unrepresented at the table.
Now, there were some changes. Supervisor Ron Roberts urged the board to pipeline renewable energy projects that are already under review and exempt them from any future policy changes. That would affect the big energy projects already proposed for rural East County. Supervisor Jacob ultimately motioned to remove parts of the work plan that called for a cost analysis of different types of renewable energy and energy delivery models, such as comparing rooftop solar costs to giant industrial-scale wind and solar projects, in order to get the rest of the measure passed by her colleagues. Patrick Brown, who is with Soytech, a solar manufacturer, told the board that it's not the county's job to do economic planning and that it should be left to the free market. But Tisdale said, if they really thought their projects were economically viable, why wouldn't they want an economic analysis? Another speaker was Sean Marshall, who helped form a community choice aggregation energy model in Northern California's Marin County. He said that if San Diego County were to pay the same rates that Marin County pays, residential users here would save 6% and commercial users could save 23% compared to SDG&E current rates, which are expected to rise even farther. The plan drew strong opposition from some East County residents who testified about fear that renewable energy projects in our mountains and deserts will harm their health and be eyesores to the residents of these communities. Bob Maupin, whose property abuts Soytech's project, testified that his wife already has a rare form of cancer that began shortly after the Southwest PowerLink high-voltage power line was built through their property. He is concerned about the effects on her health from yet more energy projects. Theodore Tibbetts says Soytech wants to put its solar modules just 100 feet from his front door. He voiced concerns that they radiate heat, glare, and electromagnetic radiation. What you're doing here is wrong, said Tibbetts. You're endangering our lives, not to mention our property value. It's too close. It's way too close. Please have a little mercy.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, from the desert to the coast.
This is Miriam Raftery, and I'm back with Leon Thompson, who's a longtime political observer of politics at the local, state, and even national level. And we're going to give you some updates on the San Diego mayoral race. Now, the big news this week is that Councilman David Alvarez picked up the coveted County Democratic Party endorsement. Leon, how significant is this for Alvarez and, for that matter, the other candidates in this race?
It's significant because Alvarez is a young man on the council, and there's so many Democrats out there that have filed for the mayoral seat. But the Democratic Party, if too splintered, will definitely lose because it appears the Republicans are united behind a single candidate.
Kevin Faulkner.
Right. And so by the Democratic Party endorsing Alvarez and Donna Fry and others, Marty Emerald.
Yeah, Lori Saldana.
Lori Saldana have all thrown their hats in the ring for Alvarez, which unites the party behind it. Plus, when it comes to walking precincts, if the Democratic Party's already endorsed a particular candidate, then they're limited to talking about that particular candidate.
Right. So that's bad news if you're Mike Aguirre or you are Nathan Fletcher, the other prominent Democrats in this race, in the mayoral special election coming up in November, if one candidate gets more than 50% of the vote outright, they win. So with three Democrats and a whole bunch of other lesser-known candidates in there and only one Republican, the Democrats were concerned that they could just lose this outright. They want it to go to a runoff election if they don't win it outright. What do you think the reason was of the three prominent Democrats in the race that they singled out Alvarez for the endorsement?
Well, it's just speculation, but I believe they've chosen the candidate they think is most electable. Mike Aguirre has run before.
Right, very well known.
And he's very, very well known. He's sort of a lightning rod in San Diego politics.
True, he's been controversial. He's a little bit feisty and combative sometimes. He's also lost the last election, I believe it was when he was running for city attorney again. So maybe they thought that a fresh face would be a better choice. Now, Nathan Fletcher, of course, has changed parties twice now within a very short timetable. He was a Republican and then he was an independent. And I know I've heard from some people in the party that there were folks that just didn't quite trust him, didn't think he had a long enough track record of loyalty as a Democrat, maybe someday in the future. But for right now, they're circling the wagons around David Alvarez.
And, of course, the Republicans have pretty much chosen Kevin Faulkner to be their prominent candidate. And that puts the entire Republican Party behind one candidate, which gives him a real advantage.
Yeah, it does. And he picked up some other prominent endorsements himself. Council members Lori Zapp, Mark Kersey, and Scott Sherman, predictably all Republicans. He also picked up the endorsement from the San Diego Chamber of Commerce, whereas Alvarez has been endorsed by the Labor Council. So we're really seeing kind of a classic pitting here, I think, of the business interests versus the interests of labor and also neighborhoods, because Alvarez comes out of the Barrio Logan. He said that he's going to stand up for neighborhoods and the disadvantaged. So very interesting race in the making.
It's going to be very exciting to see what happens in San Diego in the next 3 months.
Absolutely it is. And we'll be back with more on that.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Nancy Holder, New York Times bestselling horror and fantasy author. My guest has received 5 Bram Stoker Awards for her supernatural fiction, a Scribe Award for her novel Saving Grace, Tough Love, which is based on the TV show with the same name, and a Pioneer Award from Romantic Times for Young Adult Fiction. She's written 3 young adult dark fantasy series with Debbie Vigay and is currently writing teen thrillers and horror novels. Welcome, Nancy. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Hi, Raina. I'm glad to be here.
Nancy, you have a very impressive history of writing, editing, teaching, and other things. But let's start with your choice of genre. What are the joys and challenges of writing dark fantasy and horror novels? Why do you choose this category?
I have been asked this question all my life, and my answer to is, I do not know.
Oh.
But I do know it's a guilty pleasure. It's always been a guilty pleasure. Mm-hmm. When I'm writing horror or dark fantasy, I watch a horror movie almost every single day. I make a playlist, like a menu, what I'm going to watch every day. But I have to watch them in the morning because it takes me all day to get over it. I'm a big chicken. I will not be going to haunted trails. I will not be going into any haunted houses this Halloween. I'm too scared of them. There are lots of movies I can't watch. So I don't know what the attraction is because I can only take it so far for me. But when I'm writing, I go as far as I can to scare the pants off you.
Interesting. Now, do you watch these movies as inspiration while you're writing, or you every day of your life you watch a horror movie?
I watch them as inspiration while I'm writing, and I pick the movies that I pick. I watch a certain set of movies over and over and over to get an emotional effect out of myself, and then when I reach that, it's kind of like method writing. When I'm in that mode, then mm-hmm. I start writing. So if I want to be scared mm-hmm. or tense or uncertain or really terrified, I pick a certain movie to get myself emotionally there, and then I write.
And do you scare yourself with your writing?
No.
No.
And that used to really worry me. Like, I'm not scared at all. So I don't know why. I guess because I'm in control of it.
Right.
Maybe the movie like I'm not in such control of.
Okay. Well, you also write material for properties like MTV's Teen Wolf, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, Smallville, Hulk, Hellboy, Firefly, Zombies vs. Robots, and Saving Grace. How did you segue from horror novels to TV and movies, and which appeals to you the most?
Well, I have a really heartwarming story about that because I started out actually writing romance novels, and I had written 13 romances. And I started to kind of wonder, am I just redoing what I already did? And I was looking for something new. I had a mentor whose father had passed away. My mentor's name was Charlie Grant. And he said, you should go into your bookcase at home and see what you're reading. That's what you should be writing. And all of it was horror. So I started thinking about, maybe I should make a switch here. And because I started writing horror, I had written romance. I was working at Mysterious Galaxy Bookstore, and the owner, Mary Elizabeth Hart, heard me muttering to myself while I was dusting the novels based on the TV show Highlander. I said, these are really cool. I wonder if they need more authors. She actually emailed the editor while I was dusting. I got a phone call while I was at work.
Wow.
And I came up with 13 different ideas for Highlander. I got my book contract for it while I was at work. I got docked an hour because I had to negotiate on the phone.
Oh, I'm sure you didn't mind that.
And then because of Highlander and because of my horror, that's how I moved into Buffy. And I wrote and still write Buffy. It's been going on 16 years now. So I've written more material about Buffy that's not show scripts than anybody else. And I absolutely adore Buffy, love Buffy. I will say my new passion is Teen Wolf. Teen Wolf is an excellent show. And I got to have a meeting with the creator of the show, Jeff Davis, who gave me some ideas of how to approach the novel I wrote for him. And I adore him. And oddly, his second in command, Russell Mulcahy, was the director of the original Highlander movie. So it's all come around full circle.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So your process for writing shows for TV, is it the same as novels? Do you listen to those? Do you watch scary movies in the morning to inspire you?
What I tend to do when I'm writing tie-in for properties is watch that specific property as many times as possible. Read the scripts if I have them. Mm-hmm. And I do have a secret weapon, and my secret weapon is after I've watched the show so many times I've pretty much memorized it, I watch it without the sound. Because believe it or not, still, TV is a visual medium. And you see lots of things that the cinematographer, the director, the production designer have put in that if you're just watching it and listening, sometimes you miss all these visual cues.
So you transition out of the novel writing mode where you can be internal and get just visual.
Exactly.
That's fascinating. I know you also write comic books, graphic novel. Well, you're a graphic novel editor. How does that fit into the picture, and how is that creative process different?
Well, actually, it's a lot like watching my shows without the sound. Comics and graphic novels, for all that the writers want to say, especially in comics, is a visual medium. And I admire skilled comic book writers and graphic novel writers because, to me, it's second to poetry in how concise you have to be and how much you have to say in a very few number of words.
Right.
The text in comic books and graphic novels has severely decreased over the years.
Really?
There's a lot less writing, a lot more dependency on the art. Mm-hmm. And so you have to – one of the tricky things about comic books is it's sequential art, and you have to plan out the scenes so that when the person turns the page of the comic book, that's when they get the surprise. If your big reveal is in the middle of the page, then it's not like a cliffhanger at the end of a chapter of a novel. You have to plan for it. Mm-hmm. My writers and I both have to say a lot in a very, very few words and then give the artist a lot of help or guidance in how to portray what we're trying to show with words, because it is visual and the artist is king.
So it's a lot of collaboration and a whole new set of skills, really.
Yes. People say that comic book and graphic novel scripts are like movie scripts, but I disagree. I think they are letters to your artist. You're telling your artist, this is what I want you to see that I'm seeing. And can you show other people what we too are seeing?
Well, let's change the subject a little bit. I want to talk about the writing community here in San Diego, which you are a very strong part of. I know you like to give back to the community. You've taught at the University of California here in San Diego. You participate in many conferences, book fairs, festivals, and other literary events. So what is that like for you, living and working here? Obviously, you could work in L.A. You do work in L.A. But being in San Diego and being involved with the local writing community, what's that like for you?
It's a joy. It is so wonderful to see how much vibrant writing there is in our hometown. There's conventions, Conjecture, Condor, Comic Book Fest, Comic-Con. We are the yes. home of San Diego Comic-Con.
Yes.
And to just see everybody giving and taking and sharing and creating in our community is probably the most exciting part to me about mm-hmm. being a writer. I went to Grossmont Community College, then I went to UC San Diego. And then to go back and teach at my mm-hmm. alma mater was like a total rush. It mm-hmm. was really, really cool. And a lot of writers, it's hard to be a freelance writer. And over time, mm-hmm. sometimes people put up a lot of walls because we get a lot of requests for help
right.
or
right.
could you look at this? But when you connect with somebody and the only difference is that you've been doing it longer and you've had some success, there is no reason on earth that any writer in San Diego who walks into a bookstore and looks at those published books, there's no reason their book can't be on that shelf if they get enough support and some guidance. And that's what I like giving back to. That is a real rush to me.
So despite how busy you are and how successful, really, you enjoy mentoring other writers.
Absolutely. Yeah. I teach in a Master's of Fine Arts program for the University of Southern Maine. And
okay.
It's a residency. And to see one of my students get published is like, that's
great.
The best.
Right.
And there used to be the San Diego Writers Haven here.
I remember that.
I worked there. And I still get people still are in contact with me. And several of my people, I had a workshop there, like an open mic night. And several of the people who used to come to that have been very, very successful. And that is just the best. That's fabulous to me.
Well, how wonderful that you're taking the effort with other
Thank
writers
you.
Like that.
Thank you.
Writers helping writers. One last question, Nancy. What book are you writing next, and when will it be available?
I am, as we speak, I'm on deadline to finish a teen thriller called The Rules, and I'm writing it with Debbie Vigay again.
Okay.
It will be out in 2015, I believe. We have a long lead time on this, which is fine with me because I really want to get it right. So for my playlist for that one, I'm watching the Scream Quadrology. So I watch Scream, Scream 2, Scream 3, Scream 4, and I watch 30 minutes a day of each one because that's when something happens. Every 15 minutes, Kevin Williamson is right on the money with how he laid out those scripts, and they're perfect for working on a teen thriller. And The Rules is the name of our book. It'll be out from Random House, Delacorte.
We look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Well, our time is up, but thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Raina. And to everybody out there who's an aspiring author, just keep going.
Okay. For more information on Nancy Holder, visit her website at www.nancyholder.com. She's also on Twitter at Nancy Holder and on Facebook at www.facebook.com/NancyHolderFans. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. Hi, this is Connie again, and I'm talking to you about what you should be thinking about planting now. And in another couple of weeks, you better not be thinking about it, you better be doing it. So what do we start with in the fall? You think green. Think of all those greens that you love to eat, because this is the time to get them in the ground. Asian greens, mustard greens, spinach, and my favorite, beet greens. Except you get a double payoff with beets. In fact, you get about a 5 or 6 payoff with beets, because every little beet seed that you are planting actually is an old dried up flower, and it contains 5 or 6 seeds in it. So when those beets come up, you've probably wondered in the past, why, if I only planted 1 beet there, do I have 5 little plants there?
What you can do is wait until they get to be about 2 inches tall, and then, using your very most delicate touch, wet the soil and carefully, using your fingers on the leaves, pull out those extras. Leave the biggest one in place, pull the others, and immediately replant them 3 or 4 inches away from the mother plant, or start another row, but get them a ways away from each other so that they will each have room to grow. As they grow, you can enjoy pulling off an occasional big leaf and stir-frying it or cooking it up, braising it in a pan. They're my favorite greens, like I said. Eventually, much later, you will end up with full-grown beet roots that you can pull out and cook. So now's the time to start your beets. What else can you start now? Broccoli, everything in the cabbage family, kale plants. Pull the old ones from last year that are dried up over the summer. Get some new kale going. You can start cilantro now, and you will have to replant it again in about 2 months because cilantro doesn't last forever. It goes to flower too soon. But at this time of year, with the cooler days and nights, it takes longer for it to bolt into flower. So cilantro is a great thing to grow right now. Right now, I just started my peas. I use Chinese edible pod peas, but any kind of peas can be started now. What you want to do is soak those seeds overnight or even for 48 hours and then plant them. Poke them into wet soil, get them down about an inch or so, inch and a half, cover them well. And I want to mention, when all these seeds that you plant, the smaller the seed, the closer to the surface you plant it. And always press down hard. Annie's Annuals up in Richmond is run by a delightful woman who talks about how she started her first batch of annual plants. She planted them outdoors in flats. The seed flats were right there. She was so upset because her cat ran across the seed flats when she was through planting them. What happened was those were the only seeds that came up. So that was a lesson to her, and it's a lesson to all of us. Press down on the soil after your seeds are in the ground so you have good contact as well as the moisture, so things will start early. You can grow radishes year-round. You can start scallions and green onions right now. Swiss chard, I would suggest that you get that in the ground right away, hopefully by the 1st of October, because Swiss chard likes the warm soil to start. In fact, all of these seeds like the warm soil to start, and then they appreciate the cooler days as they grow and get larger.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
Will California soon be going to pot? Well, we'll find out. The Secretary of State's office has announced that a ballot initiative is being circulated for signatures that would decriminalize marijuana and hemp use. It includes the possession, cultivation, transportation, and distribution, including recreational use of marijuana. Now, it goes further. It would also allow case-by-case reviews of people who've been convicted of nonviolent marijuana offenses or who are currently charged with them. It also would let the legislature enact laws to tax and regulate the plant and allow doctors to prescribe pot regardless of a patient's age. It would ban state or local governments from enforcing federal marijuana laws. Now, of course, marijuana use is still illegal under federal laws, so even if this were passed, there's the potential that people could face federal charges down the road. Now, this is bound to be a controversial measure. There'll be opposition, as in the past, no doubt, from law enforcement and support from advocates of medical marijuana and recreational users. Some of the things yet to be determined would be issues such as how do you determine what's a safe level for driving? There's concerns certainly about that. If approved, California would be the third state
to legalize the recreational use of marijuana after Washington and Colorado that have already done so. Now, Californians rejected a similar initiative back in 2010, Prop 19. However, a new poll by the Public Policy Institute of California indicates those attitudes may be shifting. 52% of adults and a total of 60% of likely voters now say that they favor legalized marijuana. Now, it will be up to the voters to decide whether or not this gets enough signatures to put it on the ballot in 2014. And if it does qualify, voters will then decide whether or not it's high time for California to legalize marijuana. For KNSJ and East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Janice Mork, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world.
Today I'm talking with James Pearson from Ember Arts, founded in Jamul here in East County, now with offices in Ocean Beach and El Cajon. His company sells handmade jewelry that's beautiful and every color of the rainbow. They're called Aicholi beads, and there's a fascinating story behind them. How did you first discover these beads?
Yeah, good question. So I actually moved to Uganda in 2006 to work with a nonprofit. And through some friends, I met these women who were living in a slum just outside the capital. And they were working in a rock quarry, which in Uganda means sitting on the ground and pounding rocks with kind of a makeshift hammer for hours and hours every day. And they were just barely making enough to survive, about $1 a day. But on the side, they were making this beautiful jewelry. I saw that jewelry, and the only thing they were missing was a good market to sell it in. And so that was kind of how we first got involved with them.
Oh, wow. I can't imagine what those women must have been going through as they were working so long. How difficult was life for their families?
Oh, it was real difficult. So all the women that we're working with, they had to flee their homes in the north of Uganda because there was a 20-year-long civil war. And they had been moved into these really terrible displaced persons camps, and then they fled those two and ended up the only place they could find to live was this slum outside the capital. And the work that they're doing is just tremendously difficult. And to only make $1 a day, I mean, they've got kids to feed, they've got to provide shelter. It's a really tough life.
Oh no, that sounds terrible. So you noticed the unusual jewelry that they wore. These look like ceramic beads, each in multiple colors. So how are they made?
Yeah, good question. In fact, they're not ceramic at all. They're, believe it or not, they're all made from recycled paper. So in Uganda, there's this marketplace where you can just buy kind of discarded paper from around the country. They go in there, they find these beautiful colors, and they'll cut a long strip and they'll hand roll every bead and then string it together into beautiful jewelry.
Wow, that sounds like a cool process. Then you offered to try and help them by bringing some jewelry back to the United States to sell these items. How did that work out, and where are they sold?
There were four women that we started working with, and I would go and kind of hand choose every piece of jewelry and give it to a friend who was coming back to America and say, hey, take this to my family. We just sold at, you know, farmers markets and crafts markets and things like this. And then we started approaching stores, at first kind of smaller gift shops and boutiques, but the last couple of years we've been working with some larger chains like Whole Foods.
Wow, that's great that it's been so successful. Now, this is a fair trade company that you've started. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, fair trade it's just a way of thinking about business that says that everybody along the line, from the people who are initially producing something to even the consumer at the end, should be able to benefit and feel good about what they're doing. So we've worked really hard with the women in Uganda that we work with to say, what's a fair price for what you're selling us? And what else can we do to, you know, benefit your lives?
Now, where can people learn more about helping these women in Uganda, and where can they find Aicholi beads?
So our website, emberarts.com, it's emberarts.com, is a great place to learn more about it. We also have an online store there that people can purchase from, and we've got a map that shows all of the retailers that you can find our jewelry in.
Thank you for sharing your story with East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1, the Network for Social Justice. You can also read our story and see photos of Aicholi beads at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
The Sierra Club's San Diego chapter seeks public help to reopen its historic Foster Lodge on Mount Laguna and to rebuild a cabin lost in the Chariot Fire.
While there was some insurance coverage, the chapter needs to raise funds to offset a $10,000 deductible and other costs not covered to get the lodge reopened. A wine tasting to benefit these rebuilding efforts will be held on Sunday, September 29th at 4 o'clock at the Mosaic Wine Bar, 3422 30th Street in the North Park area of San Diego. You must be 21 or over for this event. For reservations and tickets, contact richard.miller at sierraclub.org or call area code 858-569-6005. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.